The late renowned political leader Thomas P. Tip O'Neill was famous for his observation that all politics is local. Now, he was referring to the United States, of course, but the adage was well demonstrated in an understudied aspect of Soviet history, the nearly four decades of de-Stalinization between the dictator's death and the dramatic end of communism. A closer look at the period suggests that de-Stalinization was not the failure some suggest, but rather a fertile period of public interaction with government policy that suggests vital lessons for today's Russia and other societies struggling with democratization. My guest is Stephen Bittner, a fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center's Kennan Institute of Advanced Russian Studies. Stephen, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you for inviting me, George.
It's a pleasure to have you here, and especially after doing some reading and the things you're studying, which I find absolutely fascinating. Let's try to go right to the heart of them, Stephen, if we might. For me, at least, here's what I thought as I read this, that it was largely, or it is largely, a story of unintended consequences.
That is certainly true. I think the story of de-Stalinization is that the chasm which develops between reform as it is perceived at the top of the political hierarchy and the consequences as they play out at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really essential for, I think, how we understand the fate of the Soviet Union, because invariably the chasm was much wider than the high party leaders anticipated or intended.
That's right. They were quite surprised by this. We're going to go into some of the reasons they might have been. In a kind of a capsulized form, Stephen, I saw it, just as you put it just now, the Soviet leaders' efforts at decentralization setting off a kind of wave, if you will, of enthusiasm and improvisation on the part of neighborhood-level groups that led them to take certain actions, which in turn influenced what the government leaders would do.
Yeah, that is certainly true. I guess the Soviets would say it had a dialectical relationship, mm-hmm. which is the...
A fluid interaction, sort of thing.
Uh-huh. Certainly, I think it speaks to the enthusiasm we see at the local level suggests that Stalinism, what came before de-Stalinization, was in fact much less stable than I think most scholars have admitted to date.
Mm-hmm.
Because across the political spectrum, at the top of the political hierarchy, at the bottom, you see there's no question of the necessity of reform.
Mm-hmm.
And then the enthusiasm of exploring what the dimensions of these reforms are.
In other words, because there was this, there's no question of the need for reform, people were enthusiastic about the prospect of it.
That's exactly right.
Let me ask you this, Stephen, right off the bat, because again, as a layperson reading this, one of the first thoughts that pops into your mind is, now that we know the other end of the story, is there in this story the kind of beginnings or progression, if you will, of changes in public attitudes that might underlie glasnost, perestroika, and the eventual ultimate reforms that we saw?
Yeah, that's certainly true. In fact, this is, I think, partly what attracted me to the topic, is if we look at the 1950s and 60s, we see the same events playing out that we saw on CNN in the 1980s and early 90s, and particularly the struggle to come to terms with what is really an inglorious past, the chasm between Soviet socialism in practice in this great utopian ideal.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I think we've underestimated how traumatic this was for Soviet citizens who really thought they were building a more humane political system, and suddenly they're told that it went terribly awry, and mm-hmm. now we're going to try to fix it. And one of the ultimate ironies of Soviet socialism is that it created this huge bureaucratic leviathan,
mm-hmm.
but the bureaucracy just didn't work very well, at least in the sense that, you know, Max Weber had in mind. And so in order to get anything, you had to constantly subvert the bureaucracy. And this is certainly one of the central themes of Stalinism as it was mm-hmm. lived during the 30s, 40s, and early 50s. And after 1953, there's this effort to revitalize the bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
So people can go to the local bureaucracy and have their housing problems resolved,
right.
Get their social welfare.
So the idea here is to make the bureaucracy work better.
Work better.
But what we set off, or what they set off, I got a sense even, was a lot of inventiveness and creativity that might not have been expected or even welcome, to get down to it.
Yeah, of course, that's right. Once you mm-hmm. you provide this opportunity to Soviet citizens, I mean, they're using the local bureaucracy to, you know, resolve grudges with their neighbors,
mm-hmm.
to get a better housing allotment when they're not entitled to one. So it's this constant process of exploring what,
right.
I mean, what opportunities does reform present?
We're going to make this very concrete by looking at a very specific and I think quite colorful neighborhood called the Arbat that you focused on. But just to set the stage for that, Stephen, and to give people a sense of what we are talking about here, I love your phrase, everydayness, the kind of quotidian aspect of all that's going on. And do I take that to mean, Stephen Bittner, well, what it suggests, that the widest garbage collection, housing policy, where people live, where how streets are laid out, I mean, was that the kind of smorgasbord of?
That's right. You know, people just trying to exert control over the things that had a direct bearing on their everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
So job, home, work, or income, social welfare, family arrangements.
Mm-hmm. You name it.
Yeah, you name it.
Another aspect of this I want to touch on again before getting very concrete is the other end of this unanticipated experience, and that is the effect on the governors. I mean, as this sort of cumulatively began to happen, in a general sense, again, Stephen, what kinds of reactions did it get from the people who had first set it in motion?
Well, I mean, this is interesting because the process of de-Stalinization is halting. It's never in ad hoc to a certain degree. It's always a process of unleashing reform, and then once you see what the consequences of reform are, you try to slam on the brakes.
Right.
For instance, in 1956, Khrushchev denounced Stalin at the 20th Party Congress, and this released a wave of popular enthusiasm, not only in the Soviet Union but in Eastern Europe. And of course, we know that the Hungarians took this a bit too far. There was actually open warfare in the streets of Budapest, and when Soviet troops went in to quell the riots, Khrushchev tried to slam the.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing happened in summer of 57. Moscow played host to the International Youth Fair and was put on its best foot forward,
right,
for all these foreigners coming abroad. A year later, Boris Pasternak publishes Dr. Zhivago Abroad, which again slams the brakes on reform. And I think it speaks to a larger dilemma, which is once the genie is let out of the bottle, it's awful hard to force the genie back in.
Well, I'm glad to hear you as the author say that, because as a reader, I thought of that as I read it, and I kept thinking of how ironic it is how ironic the consequences can be when you introduce a degree of freedom in an otherwise controlled environment, and you want to keep the control.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's harder to do than people think. You mentioned that the Khrushchev declaration in 1956.
That's right.
And that's interesting to me for a couple of reasons, Stephen. One is the sort of process you suggested it set off. But secondly, is this whole, well, let me put it bluntly, as an academic issue, is there a debate over when de-Stalinization actually began?
No, I mean, I think 1953. I mean, certainly, mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to argue that there was de-Stalinization mm-hmm. before
right.
Stalin died. And you see, in the weeks immediately following his death, you see the preliminary steps towards reform. There
right.
is a debate, however, on when de-Stalinization ends. And some people would say it's with Khrushchev's ouster in October of 1964. Some would say it's the invasion of Prague in
mm-hmm.
1968. And even others, I think, like myself, would say that it never fully ends, that it, you know, it goes on until the very end of the Soviet Union.
Well, as we said earlier, attitudes roll on. And not to insist in the face of, you know, being absolutely wrong on this, but was there any... Was Khrushchev trying to do anything different with de-Stalinization, or claim it, or make some kind of personal political capital out of it as of 56?
Of course. This at the same time that these reforms are going on, there's a struggle at the top of the political mm-hmm. hierarchy over who is going to become the preeminent leader. And in fact, some scholars have suggested that Khrushchev was a disingenuous reformer, that he really... he was a reformer only insofar as it helped alienate his rivals to the throne.
Mm.
And so that certainly to some degree these dynamics do intersect. I wouldn't go so far as to claim that, however.
Right. Was he using it, and that is a very helpful point and distinction you just made. I'm also interested in this, the cult of personality is a phrase, And I mean, was he in his advocacy of reform, taking a not so oblique stab at the Stalin era? I mean, sort of saying that this we need this to end that kind of unfortunate personalism at the top.
Yeah, that's certainly true. Also, I think what he did is by vilifying Stalin, essentially he was putting blame for what happened in the 30s and 40s, this tremendous, usual human casualty of building socialism on someone else. Because if we actually look in the archives, Khrushchev was himself responsible for much of this brutality.
Yeah,
But by claiming the mantle of reformer. He helped, sort of vindicate himself to some degree.
right, and
So
stay ahead of the parade
that's right.
as well. As I said, and I think people are really going to love hearing about this because I loved reading about it. We're going to go into the RBAT in a moment. But Stephen, let me take a moment from our conversation just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Stephen Bittner, a fellow at the Kennan Institute of Advanced Russian Studies. Now into the RBAT. I would just love to know more about this neighborhood in general. It's a very colorful place with a storied history. I think Rachmaninoff lived there for a
That's
time.
right.
Pushkin lived there for a
Pushkin
time.
lived there, Chekhov lived
That's
there.
right.
Broadly speaking, it's Russia's version of Greenwich Village or the Left Bank. And any of your listeners who have been tourists to Moscow will certainly have visited the Arbat because I think there are three tourist sites which everybody visits: the Kremlin, the Bolshoi Theater, and the Arbat Pedestrian Mall, which winds its way through the heart of the old Arbat neighborhood. And since the middle of the 19th century, it's been the preferred address for Moscow's creative intelligentsia
Still.
still. Well, perhaps not so much now because rents in central Moscow have shot up so much since 1991. But certainly until the end of the Soviet period, it
Certainly
was
the era that you were
certainly so,
studying.
yes.
Is that why you chose it? Because it has, I would imagine, a very feisty intellectual kind of Upper East
Well,
Side,
you know.
if you will.
When I was there, my first trip to Moscow as an undergraduate in 1992, of course, the Russian economy was in full collapse. Nearly every Russian was impoverished. And the Arbat was the only place in the city which had any sort of liveliness about it. It was ground zero for the matryoshka trade in Moscow. Matryoshki are the nesting dolls,
Oh, of course,
which
right.
every tourist takes home with him. And I also was attracted a bit to the cognitive dissidents of the neighborhood. There's this very intimate street, and then towering over it, a few blocks to the north, are these huge skyscrapers of the Novi Arbat project, which really epitomize Soviet modernity and rise from this wasteland of concrete. And I was always struck by how this one neighborhood captured both the intimacy of 19th century Russia and the what can only be described as what in the United States would resemble the Robert Taylor homes in Chicago.
And
Something.
as a facet of all of that, and in this period that we're focusing on, I can almost imagine an answer, but it may be the wrong one. So let me just ask the question: what uses did the Arbat make of the reform movement that you found particularly notable? I mean, what kinds of things went on there as a result of getting more power at the local level that were significant?
Well, in the Arbat, it was a little peculiar because the neighborhood was so intelligentsia-centric. And so what you see is that there are several of the flashpoints in the politics of the cultural thaw, which is what de-Stalinization is called in the cultural sphere, actually were situated in the Arbat. And essentially what it is Soviet intellectuals exploring the past, trying to recover the casualties of Stalinism. And not only explore the past, but to push the boundaries of what's acceptable in the present, and particularly with foreign culture.
Yeah, and I found that fascinating in several ways. For example, and sort of rediscovering architectural forms
That's
or
right.
patterns that had been sort of ruled out, but they were brought back because the intellectuals, the Arbat, thought they merited that and they were
Yeah.
able to do it.
Well, I just mentioned the new Arbat skyscrapers, and they were built in the early 1960s. It was, in fact, the largest urban renewal project in the center of Moscow in the post-Stalin period. And architects in Moscow saw these skyscrapers as an opportunity to rehabilitate constructivist architecture. During the 1920s, Moscow was at the center of the constructivist movement in the world. Many of the most innovative designs came out of Moscow. But in the 1930s, Stalin's cronies cracked down and said, this is formalist, this is not Soviet. And what you see in the 1960s is an attempt among intellectuals to recover the constructivist architecture. And they're using the Novi Arbat project, the new Arbat Street, as the case in point.
And that new Novi Arbat project literally sort of redesigned the streets of the neighborhood, did they not?
That's
right.
Broader
boulevard kind of thing.
They rammed a 150 meter wide street through the middle of old Arbat.
Hmm. Another area I found fascinating in terms of the Arbat's reaction to or use of the reform initiatives was in theater. And here it seems to me they were able to take a kind of a basic mandate and expand on it and go to areas of perhaps theatrical curriculum and other things that had not been on the agenda to start with.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I think one of the central themes you see playing out in the theater is generational differences. Khrushchev was very apt at claiming there's no fathers and sons dilemma, which invariably, of course, suggested that there was, in fact, a fathers and sons dilemma. And for some reason, you see this in theater in particular. You see them investigating this, and it's always played out as the first generation of Soviets, the true believers, the old Bolsheviks. And then the second generation, which was the Stalinist generation, who had somehow power had corrupted.
Right.
And this is, you see this, there was one very important theater in the Arbat, the Vakhtangov Theater, where this all played out over the course of 15 years.
Here's my personal favorite, because I'll confess to being a lover of literature, and anyone who does has to love Russian literature. And I was fascinated by this, and I want to make sure I get this absolutely right, that in the Arbat, in this period, as a result of what we're talking about, because I keep saying the use of reform, it's a little awkward, but I think you know what I'm trying to say, but that writers began to express themselves more freely to begin with, but to establish contact with foreign writers.
That's
and
right.
I would think that would be both artistically, explosive, and politically explosive as well.
Well, it was, the Soviets were always, at least at the top of the political hierarchy, they were always, suspicious of what the intentions were of say, foreigners who came to the Soviet Union or foreigners who tried to publish their books in the Soviet Union, of Soviet citizens who showed too much interest in foreign culture. This changes somewhat after you see a loosening of the borders somewhat after Stalin dies. And there is this attempt among the intellectuals to reintegrate themselves into the world cultural sphere, where, if truth be told, the Soviet Union had not been since the 1920s because they've been cut off from the rest of the world.
Do you know there is something else, though, about this? When you said the late 50s, I was reminded of this. Are not two additional things also happening here, Stephen? One is, we began talking about this, even in the pre-Stalin years, with perceptions of adversity. I mean, and there was adversity in the post-World War era. And while I don't think the Soviet Union was ever a well-off society, it was probably a better-off society in the late 50s. And I'm wondering about just the addition of that fact into the cauldron we're talking about here. Did that influence or change?
Well, I think so. Once your basic needs are taken care of, you're free to go after the extra, what is not necessary but what you want.
Exactly.
And if the paradigmatic pattern of everyday life in the Stalin period was survival, just how do I get by? How do I not get arrested? How do I get the bare minimum in food and lodging? In the post-Stalin period, it was people were trying to carve out their own sort of comfort, whether that be defined in intellectual terms or in physical terms.
Does that mean, and I don't want it to banalize it, but that in a sense, reforms and the liberalization that follows in their path are more affordable in a way? I mean, the society is perhaps, well, I guess what I'm really, really aiming at here is it strikes me that that late 50s period is also remarkable for kind of a Soviet reaching out to the world. I mean, I'm vaguely remembering youth festivals and the use of jazz and other things that might not have been so prominent in previous years.
Yeah, this is one of the really one of the crucial watersheds, the differences between the Stalin period and the post-Stalin period. Whereas in the 1930s, you see the Soviets acting brazenly; they're confident in their own righteousness. In the post-Stalin period, there's more of a sensitivity of what the foreigners think.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, this is problematized in turn by the Cold War, that the Soviet Union is at the vanguard of the world socialist movement. This plays out in funny ways. Intellectuals, for instance, quickly learn how to manipulate this, which is if they crack down too hard on, say, Solzhenitsyn or Pasternak, it's going to create a brouhaha in the West. The very fact that the Soviet Union is now once again a part of the world creates certain liberties at home, which were unanticipated.
Mm-hmm. There's an aspect of your research on this that I've used the word fascinating before, and I simply have to use it one more time at least, and that's the public letter writing.
Yeah.
Now this, of course, as a scholar, you approach this with much more rigor than I could ever muster, but I must say, just as plain human drama, just reading these public letters, and I think if you could give us a brief explanation of what they are and why they're that important in the context of this story and in the Soviet Union, which side?
Well, the public letter writing has a long history in Russian history. In fact, you can go back previous to the revolution and you see peasants would petition the Tsar for land or for cows or for whatever. And for a variety of reasons, this practice survives into the Soviet period. Mainly, it's a way to get around this hugely inefficient bureaucracy. And so people are always writing off letters to Stalin.
These are complaints and appeals.
Complaints, appeals, but also a very peculiar kind of letter where people sort of bare their soul to where it's almost as Stalin like Oprah Winfrey or Stalin as a dispenser of psychological and emotional help. In the post-Stalin period, of course, there's this attempt to resurrect the bureaucracy, to get the government to work like it should. And they begin to encourage people to stop writing letters to the top of the political hierarchy, to the Politburo and to the Central Committee, and to write to their local officials.
Hmm.
And then the local officials could respond, and this would show citizens that these local government agencies are not as emasculated as they think, mm-hmm. and they can respond. To,
mm-hmm.
And so once people do start writing to local authorities, the local authorities are under so much pressure to respond that they usually get what they want.
I was going to say that the letters, as I say, can be read just for their dramatic content, and they're both very candid, often very colorful, complaints about families, drunkenness, misbehavior, that kind of thing. But, and I think you've just confirmed it, I got the impression when they got to the local civic council level for adjudication, the general reaction was to be sympathetic to the most part, for the most part. Did that create problems for people above? I mean, were governors eventually worried that there was just too much concession?
Well, there were certainly some issues where you could not give in on.
Mm-hmm.
But when it came to, sort of dispensing social welfare, it was easy to give somebody 100 rubles if it would shut them up.
Mm-hmm.
It also made things more efficient because then that person, once they had been satiated, would not, continue to petition mm-hmm. higher up the political hierarchy. There was a realm, of course, where local officials could not acquiesce, and that was, anything that impinged upon the central mission of Soviet. So you could not say, "I want to abolish the party cell at my at my place of work."
You couldn't threaten orthodoxy.
Yeah, or "I want to run for office as a non-party member."
Mm-hmm. It's a non-starter.
Yeah. Mm.
What's the Again, this as a question would merit full discussion in its own right, Stephen. But just at the core of it, what's the most powerful contribution of the findings that you have made? I mean, what does it tell us about the period we otherwise didn't know?
Well, I think that's a difficult question. And of course, every historian should have to answer this at some point. But I think it suggests that Stalinism was the central issue of Soviet socialism and remains so. Only insofar as that for the remainder of the Soviet period, Soviet citizens and government officials were struggling to come to grips with Stalinism, whether to reform it, whether to halt the reforms. And ultimately, I think we have to, my research would suggest that it's the ultimate failure to come to some sorts of common grasp of Stalinism that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union, that they couldn't come to terms with their own past.
I think that's that phrase in itself, I think, speaks volumes, that they couldn't come to terms with their own past. I want to ask you to expand on it right now as we conclude our conversation by bringing that same thought into the present, because I think at the outset I said, and I think we would both agree, that there are lessons here that are valid for today's Russia, and as I added, I think maybe beyond Russia for societies that are going to wrestle with these same kinds of things. And once again, we don't have the time to give to this that this deserves, but if you had to answer it briefly, what would you say those considerations are?
I'm reminded of Jeffrey Sachs' shock therapy plan to create a market economy in post-Soviet Russia. And I think there's been the reformers since 1991 there's been no sense of the way that reform plays out at the local level. They think if you implement it at the top, the meaning of reform stays the same as it trickles down through society. And of course, I think if we've learned one thing from the post-Soviet experience is that this is simply not true. That shock therapy, to take Jeffrey Sachs' example, made a few Russians very, very wealthy and impoverished the rest of the country.
I think lessons like that themselves justify the research, and I must say I look forward to a book on this from you, Stephen.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Stephen Bittner. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Dale. Our technical director is John Tyler, and our assistant producer is Rachel Edmonds. Dialogue is presented by PRI Public Radio International and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.